Continent of Media, number 0301. Glenn Hauser here, finally, with a new edition of this supplemental program to World of Radio. My apologies for it having been so long since the previous edition, and I can only hope, as much as you may, that I will produce these shows more frequently in 2003. Continent of Media is broadcast exclusively on shortwave by Radio for Peace International, and we appreciate their keeping the time slot open, although recently filled with other programming. The official times for us are Fridays at 1900 UT, Saturdays at 1730, and Tuesdays at 2000, with the usual repeat cycle of 6, 12, and 18 hours later on 7445 and or 15039 kilohertz. Continent Media is also made possible by Universal Radio, offering quality amateur and shortwave radio equipment since 1942. For info or a catalog, call them at 1-800-431-3939 or visit www.universal-radio.com. And the DXing.com site of Universal Radio includes an archive of this and previous Continental Media programs in case you'd like to listen to previous editions or tell your friends where they may hear this one when they please. By the way, this program was recorded on January 21st. A few days earlier, in The Nation magazine, there was an article by Michael Cupps, Crunch Time at the FCC. A very important subject, I think, and thanks to Bill Westenhaver for passing it on to us, and we'll bring you part of that article. One of the most important votes of 2003 will be cast not in Congress or in voting booths across the country, but at the Federal Communications Commission. At stake is how TV, radio, newspapers, and the Internet will look in the next generation and beyond. At stake are core values of localism, competition, diversity, and maintaining the vitality of America's marketplace of ideas. And at stake is the ability of consumers to enjoy creative, diverse, and enriching entertainment. But most people and most journalists are ignoring this momentous vote. Last year, FCC Chairman Michael Powell announced that the commission would vote this spring on whether to scrap, modify, or retain our media concentration protections. These rules currently limit a single corporation from dominating a local TV market, from merging a community's TV stations and newspapers into one voice, from merging two major TV networks, and from controlling more than 35% of TV households in the nation. And now we are on the verge of dramatically altering the nation's media landscape without the national debate that this issue merits. What will happen if these rules disappear or are significantly loosened? We have some history to guide us. The FCC eliminated many of its radio consolidation rules in 1996. This action has already caused real problems, according to numerous media experts. Conglomerates now own hundreds of stations across the country. One company, Clear Channel, owns more than 1,200. Today there are 30% fewer radio station owners than there were before the commission abandoned its rules in 1996. Most local radio markets are oligopolies. More and more programming originates outside local station studios, far from listeners and their communities. Media watchers like the Media Access Project, the Center for Digital Democracy, and Consumers Union argue that this concentration has led to far less coverage of news and public interest programming and less localism. A study by the Future of Music Coalition strongly suggests that consolidation has led to the homogenization of music. Many observers say that radio now serves more to advertise the products of vertically integrated conglomerates than to inform or entertain Americans with the best and most original programming. Despite this history, we are now about to decide whether to eliminate the rules that govern the rest of the media world. If all these rules are scrapped, or if the FCC seriously weakens them, one company could dominate a region's access to information by controlling its radio stations, television stations, newspaper, and cable system. And those who believe the Internet will save us from this fate should realize that the dominant Internet news sources are owned by the same media giants who control radio, TV, newspapers, and cable. The fate of cable television and the emerging fate of the Internet should teach us that new technology alone, without rules that protect against its being co-opted by media giants, will not guarantee healthy, independent, local media. Yet the FCC is charging ahead without adequately studying the vast consequences of its actions. It has resisted calls to hold public hearings. Only under pressure did it agree to hold one lone official hearing in Richmond, Virginia. Most Americans don't even know that momentous decisions are about to be made. It is the FCC's responsibility to tell them and to solicit their thoughts. Failure to do so disserves the public interest and makes it appear that the Commission is trying to eliminate concentration protections in the dark of night. But it is also the media's responsibility to bring this story to the public. This hasn't happened yet. Indeed, some very important media enterprises have financial interests riding on the outcome of the ownership proceedings. The very institutions we rely on to be a forum for this debate are the institutions most affected by its outcome. The media are at pains to assure us their news-gathering operations are independent of their corporate interests. Here's an opportunity to test that claim. Suppose for a moment that the FCC votes to remove or significantly modify the concentration protections. Suppose that turns out to be a mistake. How would we ever put the genie back in the bottle? The answer is that we could not. That's why we need a national dialogue on the issue and better data and analysis. We need this debate in Congress, at the Commission, among concerned industries, in the media, and all across America. The future of the media, a key part of the infrastructure of democracy, hangs in the balance. Following that heavy editorial, let's deal with a variety of less weighty matters concerning a number of different stations. This item from Patrick Griffith in Westminster, Colorado, in DX Listening Digest. Following my visit to the WSM Nashville transmitter site a couple years ago, I asked if anyone knew what the large antique-looking beacon with a red lens located on the roof of the transmitter building was about. I think I found the answer. I recently acquired a very nice copy of the 1939 FCC Standards of Good Engineering Practice concerning standard broadcast stations. Under the section titled Standard Lamps and Paints for Towers is the following passage. Under particularly hazardous conditions and in areas of heavy traffic, it may be necessary to add a 24-inch, 500 or 1,000-watt red rotating beacon equipped with an automatic lamp changer to mark the installation. The beacon may be installed on the roof of the transmitter building, provided the point will provide proper visibility. Otherwise, it may be necessary to install the beacon on a separate tower of proper height or the radio tower itself. The recommended setting of this rotating beacon is such that the center line of the light beam shall be approximately 3-something, that character didn't print, above horizontal, 3 degrees, I guess. Our contributor Artie Bigley must spend a lot of time at the library, rounding up radio-related stories from obscure sources, many of them, on the Internet. Here's one headlined, Springdale Pupils Hit the Airwaves. You know, it may be a very local story when they don't even mention the state, but I determine this is Springdale, Arkansas. This appeared in the Morning News, or NWAOnline.net, on January 11th by Jeff Smith. A small group of pupils huddled in the back corner of the principal's office and patiently listened to their teacher give directions. Following a slow count to three, the pupils burst into gleeful unison. This is KEEN Radio, 91.7. And with that, they signed on the school's low-power FM radio station in northwest Springdale. The pupils air school announcements through a small antenna atop the school that only transmits about 2 city blocks. School officials hope to extend the antenna 10 feet so the news can reach the entire Elmdale attendance zone. The best part of the station is that the information is broadcast in both English and Spanish. Jim Robinson, the radio club's sponsor, said the station allows the school to effectively communicate with parents while teaching students strong communication skills. Pupils who achieve proficient or advanced levels in their writing are allowed to broadcast their work as a way to motivate the students. Who doesn't want to hear their voice on the radio? Robinson said the station does not have to be licensed with the FCC because of its low power. They chose 91.7 because it had the most static between commercial stations in the area and would provide the least interference. So there's quite an FMDX target, power not specified, but very, very small. 91.7 in Springdale, Arkansas. Now you might think a real station would have the call letters KEEN on record, but apparently not, at least not in the 2.5-year-old M Street directory I have, for which no station is shown, using Keen. In IRCA DX Monitor, some comments from John Tudenham in nearby Joplin. KVOO 1170 in Tulsa was doing well with classic country, and then changed to News Talk KFAQ. Ratings dropped from 5.1 to 1.3%. The worst thing was dubbing the call KVOO a big mistake. That was known as the Voice of Oklahoma many years and had been a successful country station since 1971. The same company, Journal, also dumped the call WOW in Omaha, both on AM and FM. At least they run a music format on KOMJ 590. I wouldn't be surprised if next they dumped WTMJ in Milwaukee, their original station. You probably heard it mentioned on World of Radio, but in the interim since the last edition of this program, Mid-America lost one of its few remaining AM public radio stations, KKSU 580, in Manhattan, Kansas. It went off the air November 27th. I've just found this letter to the editor a couple of weeks before that from Donice Applequist to the Salina Journal. Kansans will soon lose a longtime radio companion. KKSU will go off the air for many of its listeners around the state. Quality of life won't be as good. Since 1928, KSU has carried out the spirit of a land-grant university by reaching beyond the campus to bring news, information, and ideas to the general public. Now the university has made a settlement with the out-of-state owners of WIBW to give back rights to broadcast on its frequency in exchange for a relatively modest sum of money and exclusive rights to broadcast football games. Officials at the school are now not pursuing acquisition of substitute airtime. Indeed, the money received is probably not enough to acquire suitable airtime on a strong frequency. Instead, President Wiefald and his administrators have a rather vague plan to offer radio stations around the state a chance to pick up KSU-produced programming. Most likely, such programming would be sports or agriculture-related. What does this mean for listeners? The term cultural wasteland comes to mind. What fun to live in a state where the choices on the radio dial are Dr. Laura, Rush Limbaugh, country music, oldies, and lots of commercials. Buffalo Commons, here we come. Yes, we appreciate our public radio stations, but KKSU has filled in the gaps for people wanting more. We were treated each day to a great variety. The latest in health news, consumer information, gardening advice, Kansas tourism tips, book reviews, BBC News, segments on appreciating the Kansas landscape, chats about food, history lessons. All in addition to in-depth agricultural news needed by the rural populace. Some of this varied programming was of KSU origin, but much was from other sources, such as Minnesota Public Radio and PRI. KKSU has helped make its listeners content with living in rural Kansas. We have less of a hankering to live in Kansas City, Dallas, or Denver when we can get mind-stimulating radio here without traffic jams and suburban sprawl. The university does itself a disservice in discontinuing KKSU. The station has generated much goodwill for the university. Listeners have sent their children and grandchildren there to be educated and have generously supported the university with their tax dollars and gifts. It's hard to put a dollar value on what the loss of KKSU will be to the university's future, but it will be significant. K-State football fortunes will come and go, but Kansans' need for quality radio programming will always be there. Thanks for the memories, you good folks at KKSU, both past and present. We will miss you. FM Media quotes a piece by someone in the same newspaper, the Salina Journal, who used to work at KKSU, Susan Mentert, who brought up the question, "There are disturbing questions as to whether a state entity can be sold without approval of the Board of Regents or the legislature. Kansans deserve to know the facts in this disgraceful episode." Well, this prompted me to take another look at the website, which remains www.kksu.org. And indeed, they do now have some expanded archives of programming, and the impression is that new programs are being produced, although I haven't confirmed this. A number of the familiar ones that used to be on 580. And they're also setting up a way for stations to affiliate and download the programs, apparently, from the Internet. In the Santa Fe, New Mexico area, they're managing to squeeze in yet another commercial radio station by, of course, bringing it in from an outlying town, that is, bringing the frequency allocation in. Thanks to Artie Bigley for finding this story in the New Mexican of January 14th, coming soon to your radio dial. Longtime Santa Fe radio entrepreneur Will Sims will soon be back on the air with a new FM radio station with eclectic music and local news. KENC Enchantment FM, licensed in Pecos and based in a Cordova Road office in Santa Fe, is expected to go live in mid-February. It's 25 kilowatts, using a transmitter in Pecos and a 5-kilowatt booster in Santa Fe to provide coverage of both communities on the same frequency, 102.9, 24/7. It'll cost about $150 kilodollars to get the station up and running, funding provided by Sims and his business partners. There is no station quite like KENC, he says. The format will encompass many musical forms, including jazz, blues, world, acoustic, Latin, even some classical, and more, but there will be limits. No rock and roll or country music, he says. We will play quite a few local artists. We're trying a format no one's ever really done. We hope it works here in Santa Fe. However, he was instrumental in creating other Santa Fe stations, KLSK in the mid-80s, and Coyote Radio in the early 90s, using a similar eclectic format. And by the way, starting this full-power station on 102.9 explains why a translator for KENW in the same area had been bumped off that frequency. They're now within the educational band. Indianapolis is also getting a couple of new radio stations, thanks to someone who was successful in commercial radio and has decided to bring more public radio to that area. Thanks to Artie Bigley for a story in the Indianapolis Star of January 6th by Thomas P. Wyman. Stay tuned. Radio Veteran returns. New ventures are country and classical. This is all due to Bill Shirk, ponytailed at 57. Like the fast-paced medium of commercial radio that finally brought him riches, he seems to abhor subtlety and closely guarded personal secrets. He's an ex-DJ, station owner, pro wrestler, admirer of Houdini and P.T. Barnum, and publicity-hungry stuntman. He once buried himself alive with a python and a pair of tarantulas. Bill Shirk is making a comeback, but not in the wild, wacky world of for-profit radio, a space where he once ran a station known as Hot 96. After 25 years, he exited that business 3 years ago with half a cool $40 mega. He and partner Bill Mays hit that jackpot when they sold their local stations to Radio One, the nation's largest black-owned broadcast enterprise. In his latest reincarnation, the high-energy Shirk is coming back as a low-power, non-commercial radio mogul, if that's the word for a businessman whose two tiny stations are losing $25,000 a month. His not-for-profit company, Hoosier Broadcasting Corp., operates WIRE, country music on 91.1 in Boone County, and Radio Mozart, WSPM 89.1, a classical music station in Cloverdale. They cannot sell advertising. They can encourage businesses to underwrite the cost of operations, hand over cash in exchange for limited on-air mentions of products and services. Well, he's quite a character, as you may gather, and you may want to read the entire story, which is in DX Listening Digest number 3-005. This from Kevin Kelly of publicradiofan.com in DX Listening Digest, dated January 11th. WFUV New York is tightening up on its compliance with DMCA restrictions, limiting how frequently songs from the same album or artist can be played over its web stream. DJs apparently have the option of making their song selections fit the rules or blocking their shows from the stream. The first casualty, effective immediately, is Vin Scalzo's famously eclectic Saturday evening program, Idiot's Delight. Besides vanishing from the live stream, the archive of more than 80 shows will be withdrawn imminently in protest. For further details, see wfuv.org/streamdmca.html. The term Idiot's Delight reminds me of this brief item from Harold Froge, a Michigan area radio enthusiast. A pirate logged on 27555 AM, which is called the International Silly Calling Channel. He heard it January 14th from 2020, past 2115 UT, with continuous entertainment. Check-ins included the old fudge packer, assorted sound effects, incredibly poor singing, and a lot of pent-up anger. But it was mostly good. Joe Buck reports that Sirius Satellite Radio has made a number of channel lineup changes, including the addition of two new talk streams addressing political opinions in the USA. Folks to the left of center have recently lamented the lack of programming to balance the right-wing opinions rampant on U.S. talk radio. So Sirius has started Sirius Left, and Sirius Right. Take your pick. Right will focus on conservative-leaning issues, of course. And Sirius Left will have a new talk lineup reflecting all degrees of liberal ideology, a focus on progressive issues and commentary, including commentary on political and social issues from personalities such as Peter Werbe, Ernie Brown, Mike Malloy, consumer advocate David Horowitz, and Sirius' own John McMullen. Furthermore, Bill Westenhaver mentions that Sirius Satellite Radio has started a gay radio network, or rather will be in about 2 sesquimonths. This was announced at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. The name for it has not been chosen yet, and the only person on board yet is, there's that name again, John McMullen, who is a founder of the now-defunct online radio station, GayBC. In the NRC AM list, Pete Taylor in Tacoma says, someone mentioned the availability of a radio DJ unit at Toys Ya Us for slightly under $10. Never being one to turn down an El Cheapo AM transmitter, I bought one. It's not bad, and grounding it to a water pipe and stringing out horizontally the 6-foot antenna wire which comes with it, the signal gets out better than what I got out of the much more expensive Ramsey. It is fixed-tuned at 1610 and comes with a bright on-air light, mic, an external input, a modulation-level light, and 4 fixed-level effects, laughing, a zapper, etc. It covers the house just fine. No mean feat, since I have a semi-local TIS on 1610 and a local on 1620. It would make a fine backup transmitter for WNRC, the station which appears at NRC conventions. I have no idea if it's still available at Toys Ya Us. Getting back to legal and enforcement matters, Sergei Sosedkin sends a story from Reuters January 2nd, radio receiver as a national security risk. Judge rejects Schubomer's bid for radio. Dateline Boston, a federal judge rejected Richard Reed's request to keep a radio in his jail cell after the U.S. government argued that giving such a device to the convicted Schubomer posed a national security risk. In a hearing, Chief U.S. District Judge William Young sided with the government against Reed, a British citizen who last year publicly pledged allegiance to Osama bin Laden and admitted to being an enemy of the U.S. Prosecutors argued in a court filing last month that Reed, whom they called a committed and dedicated international terrorist, should not be allowed to have a radio because it might prompt him to send messages to the outside world. Giving Reed a radio would violate the special terms of his imprisonment that are designed to prevent him from directing terrorist acts outside the prison that could harm national security, according to federal prosecutors. To support their claim that Reed might try to make contact with the outside world, they said prison officials in June discovered a metal object in Reed's cell that could have been used as an antenna in a radio frequency receiver or transmitter. They added that FBI investigators had been unable to determine the intended use of the object, a wire wrapped around a small metal disc that had a circuit board glued to its bottom. Reed, who is being held in a Massachusetts jail, has extremely limited access to the outside world. The government allows him to receive Time magazine on a weekly basis, but only after it vets the publication for possible terror-related material. Reed is scheduled to be sentenced later this month. He faces between 60 years and life in prison. Prosecutors said the Briton will most likely serve out his sentence at the Federal Correction Center in Florence, Colorado. In his Programming Matters column in the January Listening In of the Ontario DX Association, Fred Waterer writes, George Gentry Ministries is so obscure that a Google search turns up nothing but a reference to the program schedule on the WWCR website. I heard this broadcast quite by accident after a late night of tuning. The program comes on at 11:30 UT Sundays on 5070, surrounded by some other unusual ministries. It seems to start abruptly and end abruptly. I've listened 2 or 3 times and never heard a mailing address. He mentioned he was on WWCR and did not mention any other station, and there's no link on the WWCR page. Mr. Gentry seems to believe that white people are the source of all the world's problems. This program, like other programs of this nature, such as American Dissident Voices and Kingdom Identity Ministries, has a mishmash of theology pushed, prodded, and pulled into a grotesque shape designed to fit the presenter's viewpoint Equal Opportunity Hate. The most recent program railed against so-called black conservative Republicans and other uneducated by the so-called education system blacks. Conservative is another word for the Ku Klux Klan, which is marching daily in the streets of Washington. Toward the end of his program, he reminded listeners that black people are the descendants of the tribes of Israel, and that only blacks will go to heaven. Furthermore, Jesus was black. As far as heaven goes, there'll be no whites there. I wonder if Pete Peters got the memo. While I'm no great theology student, my understanding is that Jesus was neither white nor black. Mr. Gentry and Mr. Peters seemingly have more in common than either would like to admit. And now to something even more controversial, QSLing. This commentary by DXer Jean Burnell, now in Halifax, Nova Scotia, appeared on the DXing.info list. There's more than one reason why stations like VOCM in Newfoundland stop answering QSL requests. Until last September, I lived in St. John's and visited the station on a number of occasions. VOCM is a first-rate company with a very high reputation. It is easily the most popular station on medium wave in St. John's, and it's heard regularly by DXers in Europe, although it's a tough catch for North American DXers outside the Atlantic region. So it receives many reception reports from European DXers. About 10 years ago, prompted by appeals from a number of QSL hunters, I took up the issue of reception reports with the engineer at VOCM. He used to reply to the reports from time to time. He showed me the accumulated stack of reception reports, which must have numbered at least 100. I looked through them, and in my opinion, there were less than 10 that were worth a reply. There were a few cases of obvious fraud. For instance, one listener in California, the only letter from the U.S., claimed reception at a time that was just after noon in St. John's. However, the majority of letters from DXers were boring, rude, or fragmentary. I would not have believed that someone capable of picking up a transatlantic signal would waste stamps on a form letter with "I heard your station, send me your QSL card." But there were many of these. Isn't it written all over the place that for local stations you should use local time? Do not use SINPO, and clearly state your evidence for hearing the station? It's no exaggeration to say that more than half of the reception reports had no real programming details. Many reports were written on report forms that had been generated either by the DXer or a club. Is there anything more boring to read? On a happier note, there were three or four really excellent reports. These contained all of the required elements of date, time, frequency, reception quality, and programming details, and they were interesting for a non-DXer to read. All these came from Finland. The engineer, who I should say died of cancer about 3 years ago, answered these reports with QSL letters. I don't know the present engineer. So, what is the moral of the story? Commercial stations that receive lots of reception reports fall into two QSLing categories. The first will QSL almost everything as a public relations gesture. Nowadays, email QSLs cost nothing. Such QSLs are obviously not worth much as confirmation of reception, although I will acknowledge that a nice card or a letter on good paper might be a decent souvenir. The second category, which includes VOCM and its affiliated stations, regard reception reports almost the same as junk mail. It is not news to them that they can be heard in Europe. If someone insists on trying to QSL stations like VOCM, then I think that the letter must really stand out, a really interesting and original letter. And I would suggest one write to the station manager or some on-air personality. The engineers have seen enough from DXers. I still travel to Newfoundland from time to time, but I'm sorry to say that I won't visit VOCM or any other station on behalf of QSL hunters again. It was simply too embarrassing. If you have any comments on what you hear on Continent of Media, you may contact me at WORADIO@yahoo.com. Glenn Hauser here, concluding Continent of Media number 0301.